Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Break out the extension cord and plug in the fake fireplace. It's time for another earbud warming chat on Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Cozy. Here's Tom.
Thank you, Jeff. That's Jeff Harlan, folks, the hardest working man in show business, not just for being the official announcer of the Big Pop Fun podcast, although I must admit, I haven't had auditions. I just went with Jeff because he's a friend of mine, and he's one of the premier voiceover guys, announcers, an actor of wide experience and high and lofty reputation. Jeff was when I first came to Hollywood. Jeff came to the Comedy Store a lot because he had friends in the improv groups, and I was in one of those groups of the Comedy Store players, and he knew a couple of comedians. So he would come around, and to me, Jeff seemed like, wow, this guy is a working actor because he did everything. I mean, he was in this pilot. It didn't seem like there was a pilot that Jeff wasn't in. He did this thing and that thing, and he did this guest star on Mork and Mindy, and he did whatever. He did commercials, all kinds of – he was in every commercial on TV, it seemed. And I was just a kid actor, and he would come in to meet with his friends, and I would just ask him actory questions. Wow, when you do a TWA commercial, do they really fly you around the world? Were you really in Rome? Well, yes, they do fly you. I went to China, and I went to – wow, do they give you money to eat when you're in other countries? Well, yes, Tom. They call it a per diem. And wow, they give you money to eat. So I was a very eager kid with Jeff, and Jeff was very patient with me. Jeff also answered all my guitar questions because back then, way back in the Paleozoic comedy era, yeah, you just had a guitar and a vocal mic. So there were two microphones. You just pointed one at the guitar and one at your mouth. And Jeff was the first guy because he was working with bands and he was playing in the singer-songwriter genres and stuff like that. So Jeff knew the stuff. So I would pick his brains about acting and about how do you get these plug-in things for an acoustic guitar? What do you do with that? And so he helped me out a lot, and he's helped me out a lot now, and I appreciate it very much. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast. I'm Tom Wilson, your lovely and tall host. And brought to you by, I don't know who it's brought. It's brought to you still by me. It's brought to you by the Nerdist Network, of course, and thanks to Chris and Katie and everybody at Nerdist. But it's brought to you by me because no one's really, you know, offered to sponsor it. So we're just going with TomWilsonUSA.com, my website, and my show. Please come out and check out a show. Would you? You know what? I've been amazed at the people who are actually coming up to me after the show and saying, wow, I enjoyed it. And I listened to the podcast and I heard about it on the podcast. And me being the egomaniac that I am, I actually don't believe that they were listening to the podcast. I go, what? You were? Why? So, but thank you for tuning in. Thank you for downloading it and welcome. Years ago, when Jeff Harlan, the announcer of the Big Pop Fun podcast, was coming to the Comedy Store in Hollywood, I was working with my old buddy Blake Clark. Now, if you haven't heard the first couple of conversations I've had with Blake, please go download him because he's a fascinating guy. And I really enjoy talking to him. Blake is, as I say, I completely defend this. He is an American hero and an American folk hero at the same time. A combat veteran of Vietnam, a combat veteran of stand-up comedy and the stand-up comedy wars. And, well, he's a guy that has taken life-changing and at times horrific experiences and actually changed them into very successful stand-up comedy, which still amazes me. Blake and I were the doormen, the bouncers over there at the Comedy Store every night with Richard Pryor and Billy Crystal and Jay Leno and Robin Williams. Everybody was coming there every night. This wasn't the height of the comedy boom, which was the mid and later 80s. This was right before that. This just – the tsunami was just – the water was rising. as you know, Saturday Night Live became very popular, and Steve Martin became huge, and George Carlin was doing cable specials, and this thing with the stand-up comedy that had, of course, always been around and always been performed magnificently by Robert Klein and David Steinberg and all kinds of comedians, but this it was becoming a cultural tsunami as everyone wanted to go out to clubs to see this thing that was happening with guys and girls with microphones just talking and writing their own shows and just putting them up. So this was just as the water was rising and the wave was almost cresting. So there was this was the Comedy Store. It was on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. It was the epicenter of the comedy world at that time. And I was a kid who came into Hollywood with a guitar strapped around my back there and just some jokes and some songs and just – and you know, I was going with Tom Wilson at the time because since I was a kid – no, Tommy just wouldn't do anymore. I wasn't going Tommy because – well, I had a baby face and I was a big guy and I was energetic. So of course you can only imagine on the Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood that nightclub people would come up with nicknames for me. So very early on at the Comedy Store, I was Kid Comedy. I was Baby Huey, the man child of Hollywood. I was, I didn't mind. They called me Joy Boy. Okay. A little embarrassing, but eventually I embraced Joy Boy because I went for it. Yeah, fine. I'm Joy Boy. At least it sounds joyful and great. But Blake Clark was the only person allowed to call me Tommy because, well, as I said, I was going for Tom. I was being a serious actor, auditioning for serious things. I was trying to be a comedian of real power and a presence on stage. So Blake called me Tommy as a few of my cousins still do, as a couple of my aunts, but people generally just don't. But Blake had memorized the poem Tommy by Rudyard Kipling. Because Blake, being a soldier himself, Tommy the poem is about Tommy is just the soldier who we need to fight our battles, and then as soon as the battle's over, we just discard because we don't need him anymore. So Blake knew the poem, and I come up to the Comedy Store, you know, on any kind of any night. That was just it was just bustling and hustling and glass clinking and cocktail waitresses squeezing between tables of eight people and just comics shouting into the microphone. And just it was hot and this vibrating mass of humanity as people – there's a line down the street of people just desperate to get into this place to experience what was happening. So I walk up with my guitar and I walk into the darkness and I finally see Blake. And Blake and I at the time, we were not – living the lives of debauchery that many of the comedians were. You know, it's a nightclub on the Sunset Strip. Lots of highly questionable, unusual, and even illegal things were going on. Blake and I were from the East Coast, and Blake was from Georgia. I was from Pennsylvania. But it was like both of us were at a job interview for an insurance company. Blake and I wore, like, chinos. I actually wore white Bucks shoes. Yeah, like Pat Boone wore. I had them. I think they were they were actually my band shoes, really, from the marching band. They were just covered in shoe polish from being in band. So I figured, hey, it's the stage. You know, I'll wear kind of my white band shoes, and it'll be kind of neat with chinos. Well, I did wear chinos. I didn't go to – I went to a colorful thing later, but – I was wearing my white band shoes. Blake had Bucks too. Blake was wearing Bucks, which were saddle shoes. Blake was wearing saddle shoes. I was wearing white Bucks. We were both in chinos with kind of Oxford cloth, like button-up dress shirts. Blake wore a tie a lot of the time. I couldn't go for tie. But we were dressed like that in the midst of this Hollywood debauchery. But both of us were just working our shows. I would walk up to Blake in the darkness of the club to greet him. And he would have this stone-cold serious look on his face. And I'd say, hey, Blake, how's it going? And he would just go into the poem. He's, Well, it's Tommy this and Tommy that and Tommy, how's your soul? But it's a thin red line of heroes when the drums begin to roll. The drums begin to roll, my boys, the drums begin to roll. Oh, it's a thin red line of heroes when the drums begin to roll. And I go, are you doing a show tonight? He goes, yeah, 10:30. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Blake Clark.
It's Big Pop Fun.
We share, you know, you were talking about this stuff that I had this experience in Vietnam, and it is, and it's very intense, and it's different and unusual. But we share some unique and different and intense experiences at the Comedy Store. We were both doormen there, and you said bouncers, but we had to do that occasionally.
Mostly doormen.
But you think about it. We had to be not only comedians and go on stage and entertain the people, we had to be diplomatic.
Oh, absolutely.
We had to know how, I mean, some of the people who came into those places, came into the Comedy Store, my God.
We definitely weren't bouncers the night the Hell's Angels came in.
No.
Do you remember that night?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, you were in the cover booth.
Yeah.
I was in the main room. And these guys come in, and they're already, you know, you as a doorman, you know.
Right.
Guys are walking up to the door, already making trouble.
Right.
You know, this is just going to be bad. And you're saying, kind of, fellas, maybe there are like rock clubs about a block down that way. There's a bar right down that way. You can drink over there. And, oh, we're coming in here. Well, if you guys, you know. And then it became kind of physical.
Right.
And then before they even get in the room, you're telling the cover booth, call the sheriff.
I'll never forget this. The guy already pushed me, shoved me back. And I punched the door, the little blinds were closed on the cover booth, and I punched it open, and I said, call the police. There's nobody in there. And the guy goes, you're going down. And I went,
no, you took out the receiver. You got the phone.
Oh, I did?
You picked up the receiver. Believe me. The guy leaned over. There's this small hole.
Right.
That's the cover booth where they take the money to go in.
Outside the cover booth.
You were outside the cover booth.
Yes.
So you're reaching in.
Okay.
Going like, call the sheriff.
Yeah.
There's nobody in there.
Right.
You pick up the phone receiver.
Right.
You lean hard to pick up the phone receiver. The guy goes through the hole and hangs up the phone on
right.
you.
Right, yeah.
Okay? Puts his finger on the, on the receiver thing there.
And I'm thinking, this is not going to be a good night.
And then who walks up?
Richard Pryor walks up
with
James Anderson and Rashawn.
His two bodyguards who are guys.
And he goes, what's going on here? And I went, I got it, Richard. And he goes, what's the problem? And he steps up in between me and this huge guy. And he goes, what's the problem? And they realize it's Richard. And meanwhile, you know, James and Rashawn are flanking him. And Richard just turns and says, go in the back and have a Coke. I said, no, I'm okay. He says, go in the back. Okay. So I just left him alone with Richard. And he ended up, I don't know, bringing him in, letting him watch the show or something.
Before what happened?
Before what?
Before they came and apologized to you.
Oh, yeah. Well,
have Richard or
but
that, James
you know what?
Rashawn
I think they really meant
them.
It because one of the guys said, man, I didn't know you were a veteran. I would have never pushed you if I knew you were a veteran. And I went, okay.
Well, there's some biker respect
for
the U.S. veteran.
We had to be diplomats. I mean, there were some nights, as you well know, especially a showcase night, a Thursday night, where there were people in there, half the audience were agents, managers, network executives, studio heads. Some Thursday night, Mitzi had a whole lineup of people. I don't remember who all they were. So there were, like I said, agents and managers, high-powered. This is the Hollywood elite. Not that they're better than people, but they're in the Hollywood power. So Mitzi says, I have people waiting to get in. There's like four people outside waiting to get in, and then there's no table. And she goes, kick them out of here. And I went, Mitzi, that's the vice president of ABC. I know who it is. Tell them to get out of here. The showcase is over. I looked out the door. There's four people. So it's like the time
Mitzi,
for people, Mitzi still owns a comedy store on Sunset Strip, and Mitzi. I think she's been choking the goose laying golden eggs for her entire life. What's it doing? It's laying golden eggs.
You only laid 50. Why 51?
Let's kill it.
Yeah. It's no good anymore. So I look out the door, and there's four people waiting to get in, and I said, at the time, I think the cover charge is $5 a head. So I took out a $20 bill and went, here. I'm not going to – I said, you know, I'm not here just to be a doorman. I might want to one day work for ABC. I'm not going to go up to the vice president of ABC and throw him out, you know, because he might remember that. So here, here's $20. I'll pay for the cover of those – people. And she took it. She took the- I swear to God, she took it. She took it.
There's Mitzi in the nutshell.
Yeah.
Really.
But
All right. Lake pay their covers.
But when they're done, you get them out of here.
Yeah, okay, Mitzi, fine.
I was outside the original room once, and Jeff Altman was there. And Jeff and I would always kind of a silent understanding that something was going to happen improvisationally between us in front of a lot of people. Yeah. It didn't matter who was there, but he was going to either throttle me, throw me against a wall, because he's much smaller than I am, or he would just punch me and I would be knocked unconscious. Yeah. So he's out there, and he is showcasing for a bunch of industry people. I don't know who it is.
Yeah.
But a few guys are there waiting to get in. They're in suits and everything. And at that moment, Jeff starts in with me.
Oh, my God.
Okay? So these guys are there. And I don't know who they are, but it's like, do you commit to the bit? Or do you not? You know, do you bail on it? Yeah. I can't bail on it, man. That's the comic spirit there. Like I said, that the improvisational flame that was going on there. I am not going to not do a bit with Jeff Altman. I don't care who these guys are. So he starts in with me with that, like, look, excuse me, sir, you, the big guy. Yeah, I'm trying to prepare for my show. So if you could go just down the stairs. And I've said, I work here. I'm a comedian here, and I'm working the door. I don't care who you are. I have important people coming here tonight, and I want you to walk down the stairs and look out on Sunset Boulevard, and don't bother me when I'm preparing for a very important performance. Now, the guys with suits are kind of turning and everything. And I said, sir, you need to understand something. So we go into it. The guys with suits come toward me. Saying, you know, and one of them says, listen, I know it's a situation. We've come out to see him. All these guys, they bring out all their business cards.
Oh, my God.
And you know, it's like my career possibly is in my hands. I don't know what it is, but you kind of know me when I was 21 or 22. Yeah. I take their cards in my hand, and it says all that stuff. Vice President Programming, ABC, ABC, whoever it was, all these guys. And I pretend not to look at the cards, and I just throw them up in the air. And they just flutter to the ground. And I say, guys, I'm talking here. And boom, from the side, Jeff, like fake, but missed me by a millimeter, punches me in the face. And I just go flying, bash into the door, and I'm unconscious, like upside down, laying on the staircase. And, you know, as I'm laying on the staircase, I'm just thinking, well, I probably just wrecked my career.
Yeah.
But you got to admit, I committed to,
that bit.
I did not bail on the bit.
Wow.
But that's the kind of stuff that was happening there.
I know.
All the time.
Especially with Jeff Altman. I mean, you talk about courage. That takes courage. All I was doing was risking my life.
Yeah,
you were risking your career.
Forget about your life.
That's right. Yeah.
But that was that, you know, that
I know, but what
the kind of stuff that we were doing, though.
I would never have done something like, I mean, I was as big a screw off as anybody. I was always doing weird stuff. But if I was getting ready to showcase for a big, important thing, and the people that I'm going to showcase for are waiting there, I wouldn't do something that would, did he get the part? Did he?
Hey, man, it's hurt me a lot. It hurt me a lot. But I sort of like it. I got to admit, I sort of like it. The getting in trouble, because I was that's a part of what I was. I was eager to please you or to please an audience or to please. But from my experiences in high school, but in school and in all that stuff and with society, if there was any kind of authority figure, I'm like Woody Allen, you know, in Annie Hall, where he's tearing up his own driver's license and the cop, because I just can't deal with authority, you know. So if there's a guy in a suit saying, like, I'm kind of important and I've come here, I gotta somehow poke him in the eyes. I gotta somehow do, and it's gotten me in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you might not want to upset.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was that, what I'm talking about is that experience that we had of being there at ground zero, for lack of anything else to call it, of the comedy boom. And the people that came in there, we had to be diplomats. We had, just like that, you had to know. I mean, okay, that's a separate incident. But you had to know who to treat, how to treat. I mean, if some guy came in there, you know, and you didn't know who he was, say he didn't say, I'm so-and-so from ABC or NBC or whatever, or HBO. You had to kind of be able to sense, all right, I need to treat this person with you know, a little bit of respect, not just because they might be able to do something for me, but I, being, you know, the soldier, I represent the Comedy Store. I represent this institution. I had a lot of respect. I think I had maybe too much respect for the Comedy Store or the Improv, because I felt like if some comic came in there and he didn't show the proper respect for the place, you know, like I remember I almost got in a fight with Rick Avila. You remember him? He's dead now. He was coming there to showcase, and he just came walking in the back door, and I said, can I help you? And he went, no. And he walked on in. So I go after the guy. I said, hey, pal. And he goes, I'm a comedian. I went, okay, fine. You need to check in first. And he goes, no, I don't. So I go, all right, that's it. You're going out. You're out of here. I'm sorry. You know, we usually let comics come in here. If they announce themselves and let us know who they are and what they do, we can let him. He goes, you know, F you. And I go, F you. And we're like at each other's throat. And I don't remember who it was. I think it was, it could actually have been Alan Bursky, who came up and said, hey, leave him alone. He's showcasing tonight.
Oh, say to you,
yes,
to leave
to
him
me,
alone.
Leave him alone. He said, he's okay. He's showcasing tonight. It was some agent. It may have been Alan Bursky. It may have been another agent.
It was probably Alan Bursky.
Yeah, probably.
When he wasn't chasing Ronnie Kenny around the original room with his gun.
And then I said, you know, you could have told me that. You could have, you know, just proper respect, you know. And he just continued to say F you and whatever. I don't know if he got the part. I hope he didn't, but he's dead now. It doesn't matter.
See, mess with Blake,
you die.
Dead. But those relationships that you had have certainly, I mean, have followed both of us. We still have lunch. We're still close. Have followed us to this day. And hey, I always joke with people that you're now in so many wonderful Adam Sandler movies. And I thought I was nice to Adam when he was a kid, but apparently you were way nicer to Adam than I was.
I met him right when he got out of NYU. We did this stupid movie called Shakes the Clown, which was
Bob Goldthwait.
But anyway, you know, it has a cult following. It's funny. It has one of those cult followings. And it wasn't a bad movie. I say, it was a stupid movie. It wasn't a stupid movie. It was about comedy, and we were all clowns. Everybody was dressed as a clown, and it was about comedy, stand-up comedy.
With all stand-ups in it. And I remember talking to Bob Goldthwait at the just about the end of shooting and how shooting going, Bob, and everything. And at that point, this is many years ago, but he says, I realized by the end of shooting, I put a lot of stand-up comics in it, and I realized I should have just put Urkel in it. <You
know? laughs> But we got to know each other in that thing, and he actually got Saturday Night Live when we were doing it. Man, I don't know. We just hit it off. We became buddies.
And how many movies with Adam have you done?
Nine.
I think,
yeah.
That's great.
See, Waterboy was my first. Then Little Nicky, Mr. Deeds, Click, Bedtime Stories, 51st Dates.
I think it's unbelievable when you do so many movies with a guy, you're actually going, was I in that? That's good.
Yeah, but he's, I mean, a lot of them is just very small parts, but Adam is fiercely loyal, you know. He's very, very loyal, and he's very, very, just a great guy.
Oh, I think he's a wonderful guy.
He's one of the nicest people I've ever met.
Absolutely.
You know? And that's great to be, as successful as he is, and as big a deal as he is, to still be that nice a person.
Absolutely. You know? I still see him now. Or I saw him at a script reading a few weeks ago, and he said, when I was starting out, you were so nice to me. Yeah. And you're always welcome, you know. So, you and I were that way anyway.
Yeah.
But if that's not a commercial for being nice to everybody,
right, yeah.
Because you never know where they're going.
We were nice. I mean, Harris, on the other hand, would insult everybody, but nobody took it. I don't think after a while they realize it's just an act.
Right.
Yeah. But he would insult people.
He was a doorman as well at the comic store. Yeah.
I remember some guy comes in and goes, "Hey, nice outfit. What, Paul Revere and the Raiders have a yard sale?" And this woman came in, she had on this evening dress that was crinolated or whatever you call it. I don't even know if that's the right word. It's got folds in it or something. He goes, "Oh, nice dress. Nice to know you found a use for an old coffin liner," because that's what it looked like. But he would do stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And then everyone would laugh, and then I think the people would realize, you know, but he was serious.
Right, right.
He meant it.
Yeah.
And then he would a lot of times insult people who were coming in for showcases and stuff, and he was a character.
Yeah.
Very Damon Runyon-esque type guy.
He really was.
Yeah.
And a friend early on, a friend of Letterman's and all those guys. I mean, Harris is quite quite infamous around comedy circles.
Oh, sure. You say Harris Pete to Letterman, Leno, Reiser, Seinfeld, they'll always go, they'll have a Harris story. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what – I don't even know all the Adam Sandler movies, but you are really very well known for one of them, aren't you?
Probably Waterboy.
Waterboy.
And it's then 51st Dates,
uh-huh,
where I played Drew Barrymore's dad.
Uh-huh. And but, the Waterboy, you had the
Cajun accent. Yeah, yeah. Man of Time, Bobo Sanofi.
Right, right.
Quite right, you play with him with Bobby Shetaki.
And but for years you had to do that on stage, right?
I would walk out I would do that quote, "Man, how about Bobby Sanofi?" And then the people would go, you know, applaud. And as that movie became more and more popular in DVD and Blu-ray and pay-per-view and all that stuff, it would be, you know, quite a reaction. And mm-hmm. I would say the biggest part I ever had in a movie, which it isn't, but this was the joke, biggest part I ever have in a movie, can't understand a word I say. I'd say effing word I say. And I said, I got show business right where I need it, you know, right by. I said, "Oh, come on, I'm hanging by a string over an abyss." And then I would go into my act, and it would be different ways I'd start, but I'd always start it with that quote, because you know one of the things I notice about people, human beings, is they like to see the people that they recognize do what they recognize them do. Like, I know Jimmy Walker never wanted to do Dynamite, and toward, you know, the end of his run as Mork, Robin never wanted to do the Mork stuff. But I felt like, you know, this is what they know me for. This is why they're here. Because they recognize me from that, so I would do the quote. I would mm-hmm. do the little thing.
But it's good. I mean, that's what I do too.
Yeah.
In my show, you do it right off the bat,
right.
Joe.
And get it over
right
with.
At the very beginning. Here, I know why some of you came. Here's the thing.
Here's the deal.
You get to, I recognize that. Yeah, that's right, the thing I recognize. Okay, let's have a great show. Boom, and then you.
But
and then, you
then there's always people who do it. You know, do it again. Do it again. No, I have not built my entire act around, you know, Hey, butthead, or hey, right. You know, time about we stand in fear.
Yeah.
No, that's it. That's yeah. I did the line. I don't do anymore. I'm sorry. It's not. I'm honored that you want me to do it, and I wish I had prepared something, but I have nothing.
Well,
prepared.
There's reflecting the popular yeah. culture in their yeah. minds, and right. then there's just jumping through hoops that right. they put up that right. just keep, yeah. keep dancing, monkey boy.
Yeah, right.
No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think I'll just do I'm what done. I've come to pretty prepared pretty to do. Yeah, and right. you know, if you like,
I usually do the. Here's the way my act works. I usually do 65 minutes of prepared material, and then for like 10 minutes, I'll just you know wing it. But mm-hmm. but that, we're still into about the middle of that 65
minutes.
Yeah,
we're in the middle of 65.
Yeah, right.
So check with me in about a half hour, and we'll do the 10 minutes
people
on you.
Would start doing weird, and the more they recognize you, the more they, I'm sure you get this. They just want you to notice them. You know, people just woo! They're not even making a word.
Right.
They're just making a noise.
Yes, sir. There's no response to a heckler that just yeah. goes to woo. Yeah. I don't know what you're doing here, but I see you.
Yeah.
You're here. Let's all take 8 seconds and just look at this guy.
See, I never thought of doing that.
That's what I've done. I've yeah, just
that's
clearly,
great. That's great.
You just need attention. Let's all take a break and look at him. Everyone sees his shirt. That's a nice button-up shirt. He's wearing his nice shirt. He's wearing cargo shorts yeah, on a Saturday yeah. night on a date. Okay. Not right. Okay. That's one of those right. moves. Maybe it's summer. It's August. Good for you, sir. And now we move on with the show.
I never thought of doing stuff like that. But people would actually get up out of the audience. I don't know what it is about me. I mean, you're a big, imposing guy. And I think Sharon would say, that's my wife, she was saying, that's not for you. I know you know who.
I know who your wife is.
For the
yeah.
people. She said, I think it's you have played these approachable characters, like the Cajun coach, like Sean's dad on Boy Meets World, and Harry the Hardware Guy on Home Improvement, and Drew Barrymore's dad in 51st Dates. You've played these people who people aren't threatened by.
Right.
They like this person, and the person is approachable. So they would get up and come onto the stage. Like one guy, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, doing this thing at the Comedy Zone, and I've been on stage for 20 minutes, and this drunk guy, kind of typical, if you pictured in your mind a middle-class, sort of quasi-preppy, North Carolina, quasi-redneck, maybe good old boy type of guy. That would be him. A little overweight, not fat, just chunky, rosy cheeks, black, you know, hair, kind of a shadow beard with the rosy cheeks and you know, just sort of rotund, I guess you would call the guy. Not fat. But
you're describing him like a novelist.
Yes,
you really right. are from yeah. Georgia. He had socks on. He had just purchased
right.
them from a Woolworths
right,
down the
yes,
street.
Probably.
He was feeling...
Had bass weeds. Dockers.
Yeah.
And a Madras shirt.
Still getting over his father's disappointment in
right,
him, but
yes.
but moving forward with
probably
his life
did.
And at a comedy show.
Yes, right. Because he hadn't gotten that promotion at the bank.
That's right. That's right.
He gets up and he all of a sudden became semi-lucid. And he looks up and he goes, I know that guy. People don't know who that is. So he gets up, walks up onto the stage, and give me the microphone. So I learned over the years, if they want the microphone, give it to them. Here you go. Because whatever he's going to do, I can't write the setup like he's going to do it. So I let him do the setup, and then I'll, you know. So he said, hey, yeah, here, boy, meets one. What a boy. Let's hear it for him. Hear it for him. And, you know, a few people would clap. And he goes back and sits down. And the way I deal with it, rather than denigrating the guy, I would turn it on myself. I'd look out at the audience and go, okay, did that just happen?
Right.
Or did I have some flashback to a show in the 80s?
Right.
That guy came up here and said all that, right? And, yeah, okay, all right. So I would do that.
They would come up on stage.
Yeah.
I've gotten so much mileage out of people thinking that maybe, you know, I'm actually a tough guy.
Right.
And, you know, that I have a lot of purchase with a heckler. Because
right.
They just believe when I say, hey, that's enough, you know,
right.
knock it off.
Well,
in my head, I'm just saying, I pray they don't do anything because I'll immediately cry, throw the microphone down, and run to heaven.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I asked Daily Pike.
Oh, okay. Well.
I don't know what he did to you. All I know is we used to have these.
Yes, Blake saw me lift a man and slam him to the ground.
Slam him to the ground and get on top of him and point your finger in his face and say, don't do that again.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, it exhibited so many admirable things in a person. First of all, that you could pick someone up. And do that. I mean, just really twirl him in the air and slam him down. That's not an easy thing to do to a guy who weighs about 185 pounds, which is what Daily Pike weighed about that time.
Yeah.
He just literally picked him up, twirled him around, and slammed him on the ground and got down on a knee. And you had established dominance. You had established the fact that you're big enough and strong enough and upset enough to seriously hurt him. And all you were doing was admonishing him. You just don't do that again.
Right.
And
I didn't hit him or anything.
So that showed showed not only power, leverage, ability. It also showed restraint and I thought a respect for another human being, that even though you had him on his back, you weren't going to humiliate him or beat him senseless. You just said, gave him a warning, don't do that again. Because I'll get you back in this position, and I won't say, don't do this again. I'll pound the crap out of you. And I always thought that was admirable. So, yeah. So this stuff about –
well, there's a percentage of me
– You are a tough guy.
No,
yes, you are. You are. All right. Asterisk.
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 Asterisk on it.
All right.
Because I'm
– You're a tough guy. Asterisk.
I'm okay. Part Lenny from Of Mice and Men. Okay. The
yeah.
big guy
pissed him off
who
and you,
just
yeah.
says – who can grab
yeah,
someone
right.
and not
yeah.
allow them to move and just go, stop bad things that you're doing. Stop. You're making me mad. I'm using my words now. Stop.
That's right. I'll go live up in them hills.
That's right.
I find a cave.
I find a cave and live off the fat of the land. Rabbits, George.
I get to tend the rabbits.
I'll tend the rabbits and we'll live off the
yeah,
fat of the land.
So, okay. Yeah. So anyway, you are a tough guy. So you would say to them, stop it.
But yeah, I've gotten out of a lot of trouble, fortunately,
yeah.
just luckily.
Right.
You know, because friends of mine, yeah, they were in fights or they get jumped after a show or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You're in
right.
you know, you're working pretty rough towns and rough rooms in those towns.
Especially now. I don't, you know, back when I was doing it, you know, I didn't play that many tough places. Some of them. And you know, there was a couple of places where people where they had an armed guard because
you always knew if it's like that the off duty cop with a gun
yeah.
doing the door, you know,
yeah.
oh, that's code,
or
for
just not even doing the door, just being around
yeah.
in the place.
You like, just kind of know. Well, Friday
Dover,
second show is going to be interesting.
Yeah, Dover, Delaware. They always had a cop escort you back to the hotel or back to your car or whatever, and. On Saturday night, he would have his weapon, and he would have it visible because he said, they know you get paid on Saturday night.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. yeah. That's what you're thinking.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to come back this way. Hey, we'd love to have you back. You're like, I don't know
about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I didn't play. There were a few, but I'll never forget this. We were. There was a guy, Alan Ball. Do you know Alan Ball? Not the producer, not the guy who did some TV shows. I don't remember what it was. But Alan Ball, the comic. He was from like Arizona or something, real tall guy, real quiet, funny guy, very funny. But he's about like 6'5 and thin. He had tattoos and he used to, back before it was popular to have tattoos, and he'd always wear long sleeve shirts because he had these tattoos and he didn't want the people to know he had them. We were playing Jackson, Mississippi. It was like a nightclub type thing because we were the stage and then they had a dance floor and the people and then there were these people back at the bar and they were heckling us a little bit and I returned their heckle a little bit, you know. So anyway, we're doing these one-nighters and through Mississippi and Jackson was the place. And after the show, we were going back. Alan Ball had a car. I didn't. He was the middle act. He was driving me around, and we were doing these one-nighters. So the cop says, I'll walk you to your car. Oh, it's not necessary. He goes, no, I think I better. Armed, uniform, gun, nightstick, big guy. And we go, okay. So he's walking us back to the car. He goes, well, I can't tell you guys what to do, but, you know, there ain't that many hotels in town. They'll probably figure out where you are. Who will figure out where we are? Them guys at the bar. Oh, so you think? I think you should get out of town. Okay, thanks. So we go, and Alan Ball, you know, he's from Arizona. He's kind of arrogant sort of guy, 6'5", rock and roll guy. I'm saying, all right, well, I'll get packed and we'll get out of here. He goes, what? I said, I'll get my stuff packed and we'll get out of here and we'll go somewhere. And he goes, I'm not leaving. I said, okay, well, then I guess I'll rent a car or catch a bus or something. I'm getting out of here. He goes, are you serious? I went, hey, the cop who's a cop in this town said to us, I don't know if you, they know, they'll figure out where you are. If I were you, I'd leave town. I'm leaving town. You want to stay here? Stay here. I'm out of here, okay? I grew up in the South. When a cop gives you a warning like that, you take it. And then you know, I packed my stuff, and then I came out of the room, and I was going to go somewhere. I don't know where I was going to go, try to rent a car, and he came out with his stuff packed, put it in a car, and drove away. So I don't know what, if anything, would have happened, but we didn't stick around to find out. We just went on up this road and found a motel and stayed in it.
Man, oh, man. Well, those are the kind of places, but fortunately not too many of those.
No, it wasn't that many, or you wouldn't keep doing it, for God's sake. But it, you know,
but it all led you to be the movie star you are today.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I'm a big movie star.
Adam Sandler movies.
Nine. But there,
Asterisk.
But no, but you know, you had similar situations, I'm sure.
Oh, well, many in the parking lot after the show whatever, just saying, you know, just putting down my stuff. When I drop the guitar case on the ground, that's the signal.
Get
you
out.
Know, it's happening.
Right, yeah.
So either it happens right now or let's go. I don't talk a lot about it. I mean, to the guy. Because the guy just wants to, you know, get a beef with you and follow you to the car or whatever.
Right.
You don't know. It's okay, fine, sir, whatever. What are you talking? You told my girlfriend to shut up during the show. Yeah, I did, because she was shouting. Well, what are you going to do? I'm doing nothing about it. I'm going home.
Right,
I got show's a hotel over, here. I'm show's over. I'm leaving. Oh, you're leaving. Yeah, look, buddy, you know. Either swing or leave. You're drunk. Yeah, just go. Either it happens or it doesn't. Come on. Blah, blah, blah. And parking lots.
And you don't think you're a tough guy?
No, I don't.
That's the true test of a tough guy. You drop your thing. You go, all right, you're going to do something or you're just going to talk? Because I'm ready. That's tough. That's not even tough. That's a guy who just says, do it. I'm here for whatever. I'm not going to stand here and listen to you talk to me. Okay, the show's over. I've done an hour. I've told you everything I want you to know about me. It's over with. This is me now. You're dealing with not comic, not Biff, the guy from Back to the Future, not Tom Wilson. This is me, and this is my time. Either do something or shut up. Or get out of my way. That's tough guy. Because I've done that, too.
You've done that.
Yes, I have.
You've done that plenty, and I've done that plenty, because even though it is not our temperament, it's not our nature, but we were young guys who end up to live our lives in nightclubs. We live in bars. We make, we work in alcohol sales,
Yes.
We just sell drinks and put on a show.
Right.
Many nights, we're doing wonderful artistic stuff. A lot of nights, we are dangling shiny objects at a bar. Just going, look, shiny, 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 start the car, shiny, shiny. So, you know, and on those.
I couldn't put it any better myself. That's exactly it.
And on those nights, you just want to go like, okay, I'm done. And you're on stage, you're saying, oh, that's pretty good. 15 minutes left.
Right.
Throughout the entire show. Oh, good. You know, I have 12 minutes and I'm out of here.
And the reason that I quit doing it is because it got to that point where I would look at my watch, and when I had 10 minutes left to go, I would be happy. Or sometimes I would be, it would have to be 5 minutes. And the best time of the whole night was when I said goodnight and got off the stage. And I hated it. I got to the point where I didn't like doing the material that I had. And I was always writing. I was always creating new stuff and doing new stuff. But I just didn't like doing it anymore. And it was in Jacksonville, Florida, at the Comedy Zone. And I had spent, it was the second show on a Friday night. And I had spent 50 minutes dealing, putting out fires, and 10 minutes of doing my material.
Right.
And I walked off the stage and went back to the room, and Sharon was there. And I just said, I don't want to do this anymore. And I did Saturday night. I did the two shows Saturday night, and that was it. I haven't done it since. Because I just got, it's like you said, shiny after shiny. It got to be more and more of that than the nights where you felt, and you know what? It didn't have anything to do with audience response. There would be nights when I'd go on, and I'm sure you're the same way, where your audience response was okay. And then there'd be nights when you went on with the audience, like a first show on a Saturday, you go out and go, hi, my name's Tom Wilkins. And you go, oh, God, that's not comedy. You could literally walk out there and go, do a Lenny Pig, and the people go nuts and they laugh. But it's somewhere in between that and the nights that you hit them with your best material, right. And they just sit there. Somewhere in between there, and let's say a Thursday night, you go out and you're creative, and you're really performing the material, and you're coming up with new stuff, and it's funny, and it's brilliant, and it's timely, and maybe the audience laughs, and maybe they don't. But you walk off that stage, maybe you get one of the, you know, hey, okay, it was good. But you walk off feeling great, you know. Well, because I created. I was in the moment. I was spontaneous, and I was improvisational, and I was doing stuff. And then, you know, you walk off after a standing ovation. You go, ah, that sucked.
So here, with the peaks and valleys that you've experienced, with the harrowing beginning of your adulthood, yeah, into being a traveling comedian, an actor, acting in movies and TV shows, do you have, when you meet young people, when you find those, when you see those open faces,
yeah,
you know, the big eyes,
yeah,
the person on the set, the person at the club,
right,
who's coming up to you now, you know, when the young guy's coming up and say, you've done all this, and you have some of what I'm trying to do, a life of art, a life, right, of adventure, what do you say to people?
I used to say, okay, let's say they would say, I want to be a comedian. No, good. Good luck. And they go, what do you mean? I said, you shouldn't want to be a comedian. I didn't want to be a comedian. I had to be a comedian. If you have to be a comedian, then you'll succeed because you're driven. You can't. And that's what I lost, this need to tell this story. I've told my story. It's done. I've told it. I'm finished with it. I've told it enough times. I don't want to tell it anymore. I don't have to be a comedian anymore. I don't feel that need. And what I tell people, I think I'm more criterion than I am, say, tweenish. I say follow you, like Carter. I follow your bliss. It doesn't matter what that bliss is. You know, we think that you live over, you know, again and again, or that you have some other existence.
What do you think?
I think you do. I think it would be a vast waste of time and energy and creativity and everything if this is just it. But let's say it is. Then go for it. Follow your bliss. Do what makes you happy. If you can make money at it, great. If you can't make money at it, then find a job that allows you to follow your bliss, like your art, your comedy, your music. You know, you have followed your bliss, and you should be. And I think you've done it well. I think I had no idea you did art. I'm very impressed. I knew you did music because I've seen you do it. And I know you do comedy. I've seen you do it. I know you do and you do acting. Could have seen you do it, but I didn't know you did art. I mean, I think it's great. That's what I think you are a man for all seasons. You are a Renaissance man. That's what everybody should strive to be. Don't just be one thing. Follow your bliss. Do what makes you happy.
And you might end up to be in the position that you or I find themselves, which is, I can't believe that I fooled them for this long. But it worked. I mean, it worked. Yeah. We went after it.
Yeah, and that's what I lost with it, why I stopped doing comedy. I used to say, I can't believe I get paid to do this. It went from that to being, they ain't paying me enough to put up with this crap.
Right. But that was the nature of you telling your story, I think. I think that's the core of it, right? That you feel
I
had something to say.
Yes.
I said it. I said it to hundreds of thousands of people. Well, through The Tonight Show, through television, through comedy specials. Right. I've said it to millions of people, and you're satisfied with that, and that's good.
I'm done. And if I come up with something else that I think I want to or need to tell, not that they need to know this, not that I'm the great guru and I have something to impart to the people. No, it's something that I need to tell. It has nothing to do with whether they need to hear it.
Right.
If I felt like I had something that I wanted to say or to tell, I mean, because I've thought about, Faux running for president just so I could get some of this stuff out that I want to say. But then I thought, nah, I don't really need to say that. I think I was driven to say some of the things I said. I felt compelled to say these things. I don't feel that way anymore.
Well, in the laughter that you've created, you have done a great service to... Well, you've done a great service to the universe, in my opinion, but you've done a great service to the American fighting men and women.
Okay, thank you. That I'll accept, because that was my intention. That was my intention. Is we said never again. This is the motto of the Vietnam Veterans Association. Never again will one generation of veterans turn its back on another. And I think that had a lot. I mean, I'm not altruistic enough. When I started off doing it, it was from a selfish reason because, like Pryor said, if I could talk about stuff, it would give me material that no one else is talking about, but it would also expunge a lot of demons. That was my motivating factor at first. And then I realized that I did have, maybe I had a small part in changing the attitude toward the veteran, the Vietnam veteran. And so I kept doing it. And one of the things that I have always done is I always do whatever I can for the USO because they were the only friend we had when I was in the service. And I'll always do what I can for American service person, men and women, because they are out there protecting our freedom. And I think, that they deserve every ounce of respect and admiration and honor that we can give them. And because they don't have to. This is volunteer. I mean, I didn't have a choice. I would have never gone in the service if I didn't get drafted. I would have never gone in. But they made a choice. They're doing this because they want to serve their country. I think everyone should serve their country or their community or their state or something. I think they should all feel compelled to do some sort of service for their, you do it. You go there and you do these shows, and you don't realize how much that means to these guys. But you're serving your country. You're serving the serviceman, and that's great. But I don't feel special in any other way other than the fact that I have this, and Tony Orlando is another guy who is just a great...
Great guy.
Great guy, and does tremendous amount of stuff for the veteran, and not only veteran, but the serviceman. I mean, Tie a Yellow Ribbon became an anthem, basically, sure, for the returning veteran. And he does shows for veterans, and he actually did a show when he was in this movie, the latest one I did. He left on a... We had a night shoot. He left. Someone drove him. He didn't have to drive. But he drove like at 3 o'clock in the morning, went up to Long Island, did a and had a noon talk and presentation he did for veterans, and then had to come back that night because he had another thing he had to do Sunday. So he works tirelessly for the veterans.
Oh, he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah,
he is. And so are you.
Ow.
I could sit here for 5 more hours and talk to you. I'd have to let you go, and we both have to go eat lunch.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Blake Clark, American hero, American folk hero, with an asterisk.
Thank you.
Blake disagrees. You disagree with both, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. He disagrees with both, but I'm bigger than him.
But I know.
So
yes,
you are. So I put the imaginary medals on your chest, and there's nothing you can do about it.
But I know some heroes.
You certainly do.
Yes, I do.
You fought with many, many, many heroes.
I'm proud to say I served with some great, great heroes.
And you've done them a great service by taking the blessing of your life and going on and being a wonderful person and continuing to serve this country, to love your wife for 39 years, to raise 2 beautiful boys, and to just be a great guy. Isn't that what you're supposed to do?
Back at you. Same to you. Yes, it is. And I think you've done the same thing with 4 kids. And I think... I mean, I don't want this to become a mutual.
Yes, it's, yeah. Yes.
Oh, you're the great. No, you're the great. Oh, no,
Sammy Maudlin show. Right. Listen, when I think Blake Clark. But I think that, you know, sometimes you have to let people say that because they really want to. You are doing them a service by allowing them to show their respect to you.
Oh, thank you. That's as nice as anybody's ever put it. Thank you. And I accept it with the asterisk.
With the asterisk.
I understand, but also understand that it is very, with a great deal of humility that I accept, because I know what I am, and I'm not a hero. There were times when I was heroic, but there was also times
when you're heroic. Well, wouldn't everyone do that?
I guess.
Isn't everyone accidental? I mean, so many.
Yeah, you know, it all depends on how you felt that day. You know, like some days you have a good show. Some days you feel like fighting, and some days you just don't.
And what some of those stories are the Congressional Medal of Honor winners, and the guy would say, look, I was just running around trying to survive.
That's right.
I was, you know.
I'll freak out.
I had no option. A bunch of guys with guns, so I kept running. Yeah. I don't know why I'm here.
Yeah.
They just missed me a bunch of times, and now I'm standing here. So give me a medal, but I was just...
That's right.
I was just... Like,
every one of those guys will never say, I'm a hero. They'll say, I know some heroes, but they'll never
say... Of course. And God bless all the heroes. Yeah. And thanks for being with me, Blake.
Thanks for having me.
I just find Blake's story, his life, fascinating. And they don't make them like Blake anymore. Can I use that cliche? But trust me, they really don't. I have one more segment with Blake, but I'm going to give Blake a rest a little bit, do some solo pieces and some other kind of shows, and we'll come back to Blake. But thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thank you for my live show. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for helping me out so much with that. And hey, come out to a live show, will you? I'm all over this great land of ours performing and doing music and comedy, so come up and say hi afterwards. I've been amazed at people coming up and saying hi after a show and telling me how much they enjoy the podcast. So keep listening, and thanks. And hey, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.